Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Battle of Yarama in 1937, which was another of the key struggles in the Spanish Civil War, with the objective of seizing the capital of Spain, Madrid. Now, previously on the podcast, probably about a week or so ago, I talked about the race to defend Madrid as Franco and the generals swept across Spain from the west and the south. The battle to defend Madrid, the first battle to defend Madrid, was ultimately successful on the part of the Republican forces, who prevented a fascist breakthrough. And this was in part due to the arrival of the international brigades, particularly the British battalion of the international brigade. At the Battle of Yarama, the international brigades, the British, the Americans, and other brigades were devastated by inadequate equipment, training, weaponry, and they faced far superior odds from the nationalist forces, the Regulare, the indigenous Spanish troops, the African troops, the Moors as they were referred to, and also large numbers of Italian troops and a lesser number of Germans, but both were equipped with modern aircraft, artillery and armour, and were vast assistance to Franco and the other generals. Part of the story of the international brigades at Yarama was the equipping of them by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, as we'll explore in a bit here, far from being able to, or initially even willing to, supply a state-of-the-art military equipment, which the Soviet Union was far more than capable of manufacturing in 1937, rifles and other items of equipment were arrived in an ad hoc and piecemeal manner. And when they did, some were at least 50 years old. They were often rusted. They came from a variety of sources. Some had been seized from the Austro-Hungarian Empire during the First World War. Some had been seized from the Ottoman Empire during the Russo-Turkish War of 1876-78. And had been mouldering in warehouses all the way through the Russian Revolution, the Russian Civil War, and into the Stalinist era. So they were essentially good for nothing. Some of them fired 11mm bullets, which were virtually impossible to come by. It was a gauge of bullet which had been rendered almost obsolete. And they were accompanied by often pre-World War I Maxim-style machine guns, so actually nothing as effective as a Maxim machine gun. There were former military men among the international brigades. George Orwell was, having not been a military man, when he fought with the PUM, the anarchists. He had been a policeman in Burma and knew how to use a sidearm, and he looked briefly at these the collection of weapons that were presented when they came in crates, and rolled his eyes in despair. In part, this was the Soviets clearing out the junk in their warehouses. Voroshilov, the defence minister, thought it was a rather great dumping ground for useless Soviet equipment, which does make you wonder what the motivations for assembling the international brigades were in the first place. The international brigades were, as we've discussed previously, really the invention of Comintern. The Soviets knew that a Soviet army in Spain would be impossible and untenable, but an intervention using the fellow traveller movement of communists and sympathisers, those who are allied to left-wing causes, and those who simply viewed the defence of a representative democracy in Spain as worth fighting for. This was a great way of assembling a force that didn't involve direct military intervention by the Soviets. So the fact that they were so poorly equipped does raise certain interesting question marks. It might possibly have been that Stalin imagined that the Republic would be able to equip this volunteer force. However, Stalin was well aware of the blockade, and he was well aware of the fact that arms were embargoed to the Republic, and the fact that Hitler and Mussolini both were breaking this embargo to help the nationalists. So that one doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. So why assemble the manpower without the equipment? Well, it's entirely possible. One thesis is that Stalin didn't really want the Republic to win the Civil War. He didn't want Hitler and his allies in the guise of Franco to win it either. Instead, a long and bloody stalemate that would take attention, the attention and preoccupation of all of Europe to Spain was the ideal outcome, creating essentially a Vietnam in Spain for Hitler to be dragged into. This was perhaps what Stalin really sought to achieve, because Stalin was under no illusions. Even though the international brigades were heavily policed by Stalinists, there was virtually no chance of there being a Stalinist puppet government in the Spanish Republic should the Republic be victorious. Instead, you might wind up with something far worse in Stalin's eyes, a social democratic popular front government where the communists were unable to get a foothold or to fully control it, and instead all manner of social democrats who in Stalin's eyes were often more dangerous and suspicious than fascists could ever be. So creating a republic like that, or propping up a republic like that in Spain, was not exactly what Stalin wanted either. Later on, the Soviets do supply military equipment which is reasonably useful. They do supply artillery, tanks, and send air power, they send their own fighter pilots and planes to Spain. So again, the question here is that was this to do with Stalin's malfeasance and cunning? Or is the fact that a poor quality of arms was sent to Spain initially, later followed by reasonably good quality stuff, does it tell you more about the kind of the picture of the Soviet Union that Sheila Fitzpatrick paints in her book Everyday Stalinism, which is one where utopian ideology meets everyday incompetence, graft, corruption, disorganisation, and general chaos, a chaotic country that Stalinism hasn't really done very much on a grassroots level to turn into a modern and efficient society. I think that's possibly the real answer here, that inevitably the Soviet Union was in the habit of exporting its own chaotic practices. And if you look at the way in which the Soviet armies were routed in 1941 and the poorly equipped and terrified, poorly led, demoralised Soviet armies, it seems hardly surprising that the Soviet Union would have created a volunteer force overseas which responded or was treated in roughly the same way, the same amount of disdain, disinterest and overall chaos. When Franco had originally failed, well, not so much Franco as his general subordinate Emilio Mola, who had placed Madrid under siege, when the siege had failed and it had been impossible to simply storm into the city, it was too well defended by the Republic and the international brigades between them, Franco had decided that the only other strategy was to encircle the city and to starve it out. So the Jarama River was very important in this regard. It flowed about 11 kilometres south of the city, and it was essential to cross from the west bank to the east and then seize the Madrid-Valencia highway, which would have cut Madrid off completely. In his book Spain in Our Hearts, Adam Hochschild describes the nationalist troops. He says, "The majority of the attackers would be Moors and Spanish foreign legionnaires, the two much-feared groups that formed the core of the nationalist army. Although the Moors were demonised by the Republicans, they were themselves victims of extreme privation, almost entirely illiterate, with few prospects of employment. They'd been drawn to the army from impoverished Moroccan villages in a time of severe drought by a hefty enlistment bonus of cash and food that promised survival for their families. The Foreign Legion was famous for its battle cry, Viva la Muerte, or Long Live Death, and its brutal discipline. All officers and sergeants carried a small whip, and if a commander deemed a soldier disobedient or cowardly, he had the right to execute him on the spot. The attacking nationalist troops would be equipped with the latest German arms, including the 88mm artillery pieces. This extremely accurate gun, originally developed as an anti-aircraft weapon, was being used in battle for the first time in Spain. The nationalists and their Nazi allies would quickly learn that with the proper shells, it could be just as effective for long-range bombardment or penetrating the armour of tanks. Firing 15 to 20 high-velocity rounds per minute, it would become the most famous artillery piece of the Second World War, a versatile weapon that Allied soldiers dreaded. The Spanish Civil War was turning out to be a superb laboratory for Hitler." The attack began on February the 6th, 1937, and the Nationalists mauled the Republican side, killing over and wounding over 1,000 soldiers within the first couple of days. They came very close to the Madrid-Valencia road. The commanders of the Republican side quickly raced in new troops, principally the international brigades, though in doing so they must have known that they were bringing in troops that were barely trained.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The British battalion included the sculptor Jason Gurney, who went by the name Pat, and his war memoirs are very revealing. Again, Adam Hochschild in his book talks quite extensively about Pat Gurney, who would eventually be wounded at Urama and never work as a sculptor again. The experience of Gurney arriving at the Valencia Road was described by Adam Hochschild as, "It was here that Pat Gurney and his comrades were sent, ordered forward through rain-soaked olive groves and the heavy nationalist artillery fire. The volunteers were relieved to have rifles at last. We began to feel like men again, and something of the spirit of the crusade came back to us," Gurney wrote. "Had I realised that one half of our company would be dead within the next 24 hours, I might have felt differently." It's interesting always to see things from the perspective of an international brigader. The poor levels of training and equipment were highly demoralising. Men had often little to eat, very poor accommodation, very thin and inadequate clothes for cold weather. If you're not a native of Spain, it's often compelling to think of it as a hot Mediterranean country, but in large parts of the country and in particular seasons, it certainly isn't. It can be cold and rainy and quite miserable. The difficulty that the brigaders had as well was they actually couldn't go home. Once they were under military discipline, and they were warned about this before, that when they reached Spain and before, once they were under military discipline, they were considered to be a soldier like anybody else, and desertion carried with it the penalty of death. Not that any, a great many of the brigaders were inspired to desert. That was a comparatively rare event. There were members of the International Brigade, by and large, who believed in the fight and were motivated once they were equipped with the right gear so they could actually fight. And those who survived gradually learned more about fighting, but it was a terrifying ordeal of learning about warfare on the job. As the international brigaders marched to the front line, they could hear the hammering, booming of the ominous booming of nationalist artillery in the distance, and see nationalist and republican fighter aircraft weaving against one another in the skies above them. The British were able to see to their right French and Belgian battalions. And whilst there was a high degree of morale, basic equipment such as maps and compasses in order to navigate the battlefield were in short supply or non-existence. It was very difficult to communicate with other battalions because of language problems. There were a short supply of linguists, and there was virtually no field communications to speak of. Units had machine guns that jammed, rifles that were rusted. They required four or five different kinds of bullet because of the different kinds of weapon. There's an interesting story about the Italian campaign during the Second World War and battles such as Monte Cassino and Anzio, whereas the British, Americans, French, New Zealanders, Indians, Poles, and so on and so forth, had all sorts of different kinds of equipment and hardware the Germans defending just had won. And their standardised equipment made it much easier for them to fight. When belt-fed machine guns were introduced, some of the ammunition didn't fit the guns at all. The British battalion, showing its inexperience, took the high ground. It was assumed that if they did that, then they would have vantage points to see the enemy coming. But what in reality happened was that it was on a barren hilltop and took 3 hours non-stop of artillery bombardment, so much so that the hilltop was renamed Suicide Hill. They liked spades and digging equipment and entrenching tools, and so weren't able to dig foxholes or trenches, and therefore lacked really the knowledge and expertise about what to do when there was incoming artillery. Gurney wrote about the advancing Moors in his memoirs. He said, "It was terrifying to watch the uncanny ability of the Moorish infantry to exploit the slightest fold in the ground which could be used for cover. It was a formidable opposition to be faced by a coalition of city-bred young men with no experience of war, no idea of how to find cover on an open hillside, and no competence as marksmen." By the end of the first day, the British had lost 125 out of their 400 men. The field hospitals, inadequate, were completely overwhelmed. There were countless head injuries because many of the soldiers didn't have helmets, or the helmets were weak and inadequate. And the need for the disposal of bodies quickly, a lack of grave diggers, meant that some of the bodies were burned and others were simply deposited in a mass grave. When the British withdrew, they were replaced by the American Abraham Lincoln Battalion. The choice of name was not accidental. Abraham Lincoln was the US president, obviously, who stood up in the eyes of the American Brigaders, against a military insurrection against a democratically elected republic. So his veneration was seen as quite appropriate. The battalion was led by an American called Bob Merriman, who had spent time in Moscow. When he got to Spain, he joined the Spanish Communist Party and became the second-in-command of the battalion, and then eventually, during the battle, the inadequacies of the battalion's actual commander placed Merriman in charge. Merriman had been in the ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, for non-American listeners, and had he'd been in college and had been an officer in the US Army Reserve, and this meant that he had a basic understanding of how to use a rifle, a pistol, and a hand grenade. And he was able to actually train some of the Lincoln Battalion in the very basics of soldiering. The Republic was careful that the new battalions, such as the Americans, weren't able to fully appreciate how badly retreating battalions, such as the British or retiring battalions, had been devastated by the fighting. As the Americans made their way to the front, one particular horror story was the down to the disorganised nature of the Republican resistance. Two American trucks with a dozen or so volunteers, using the wrong maps, or perhaps no maps at all, turned off at the wrong junction and drove straight into Nationalist territory. The Nationalist generals had let it be known that all international brigaders would be executed on the spot, and this is undoubtedly what happened to the two trucks of American volunteers. On February the 27th, the American attack began. This was unexpected to Merriman. He didn't think that it was going to happen that day, and he knew that the men weren't ready, they weren't armed and properly equipped. Republican artillery had failed to destroy Nationalist positions or really adequately soften them up, and it had largely missed its targets. There was weak air cover. There were meant to be 20 Republican fighter bombers but only three emerged. New machine guns and armoured cars didn't arrive. The international brigades were promised an awful lot and received very little. And perhaps these exaggerated promises were there merely to kind of encourage to get men in the field. The Republican Spanish battalion that was on the Lincoln battalion's left withdrew following heavy enemy fire. And nationalist machine gunners were aiming for the Lincoln trenches. Merriman phoned brigade headquarters, where he was put on to a superior officer, general from a commander from Yugoslavia, who demanded that the Americans attack at all costs. And he also insisted that the Spanish hadn't actually withdrawn, that they had advanced far further than the Americans, and that any possibility of withdrawal would face with an accusation of treason. The way of dealing with with withdrawing troops under this essentially Stalinist system of operating an army was to accuse them of the commander of espionage, and that would mean a quick court-martial and execution. The political commissar for the international brigades, making sure that Stalinist orthodoxy was adhered to, at least in part, was the French communist André Marty. Marty was known to Stalin, they had met, and was about as suspicious, paranoid and ruthless. He was known for having international brigaders executed when he suspected them of having Trotskyite sympathies. So he was not a person upon whose radar one wished to feature. The Americans were mauled in a largely similar way to the British at the Battle of Jarama. And one of the great miracles of Jarama is that the highway actually holds, that Franco didn't seize Madrid-Valencia road, and Madrid once again had a stay of execution. The British, the Americans, French, Poles, Dutch, Belgians and others, combined with Republican troops, managed to gradually blunt the advance of nationalist forces. And a simultaneous attack by the Italians at Guadalajara on the northern side of Madrid was also repulsed. This was achieved with a terrific loss of life, and following Jarama, the equipment for the international brigades gradually improved, but it was the first brigaders to go into battle that really sacrificed themselves and did the hard fighting with poor equipment and with inadequate training, and to lay the groundwork for the brigade fights for the following year, well, the rest of 1937 and 1938. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.